Welcome to Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella, inviting you to a wonderful party. Come over here and eat my wonderful cold chicken off of this weird box. I know I have a nice table over here, but why would we use that? That's just boring. And joining me, as always, is my ever-constant roommate, only friends. Close friends only, but only friends, Chris Haig. How are you doing, my close friend?
I'm doing very well, my dear, close, long-time companion. There's nothing suspicious about that. Yeah, I'm all right. How are you, man?
Oh, good, good, good. Chris, stop choking Tom Caldwell with that rope.
Hey.
How are you doing, Tom?
I heard there's food and drink. There's free food and free champagne. That's why I'm here.
Oh, awesome. Yes. Just like a good Saskatchewanite, you're here for the free booze.
One thing I was going to say when you were like, oh, please stop talking chum. I'm like, yeah, my dad listens to this podcast now, so that's going to be an interesting one to try and explain because I don't think he's seen the film.
Uh-oh.
Hello, Chris's dad.
Yeah, I'm going to be like, ah, okay. We need to sit down and have a conversation.
Well, I'm looking forward to discussing this because when we started the podcast, both Tom and I had mentioned that this was our favorite Hitchcock film, and I think it's changed. It's not my favorite anymore, but it's still top five. I think I did my rankings, and right now I put it at third. I think I put Psycho in number two and The Birds in number one, but I frickin' love this movie, and I think it's great. And I watched it with Aubrey, and she had a few choice words for some of the characters. But before we get into the discussion on the film, Chris, I hear you have a summary for us.
I do indeed.
Excellent. So let me just move the camera towards you, up really close to your back, and then pull away so that you can begin.
Yeah, with an extreme close-up. And I love that Aubrey's giving her reviews. So, just before hosting a dinner party, Philip Morgan and Brandon Shaw strangle a mutual friend to death with a piece of rope, purely as a Nietzsche-inspired philosophical exercise. Hiding the body in a chest upon which they then arrange a buffet dinner, the pair welcome their guests, including the victim's oblivious fiancé and the college professor, whose lectures inadvertently inspired the killing. Dun dun dun!
Awesome. Excellent. Okay, let's jump into the trivia. I got a fair amount today. We got some good information for this. Rope is a 1948 American psychological crime thriller directed by Alfred Hitchcock, based on the 1929 play of the same name by Patrick Hamilton. The film was adapted by Hume Cronin with a screenplay by Arthur Lawrence. Now, we actually saw Hume Cronin on screen back in Lifeboat. He was one of the actors there. The film was produced by Hitchcock and Sidney Bernstein as the first of their transatlantic picture productions. Starring Jimmy Stewart, John Dahl, and Farley Granger, this is the first of Hitchcock's Technicolor films, and it is notable for taking place in real time and being edited so as to appear as a single shot through the use of long takes. It is the second of Hitchcock's limited setting films, the first being Lifeboat. The original play was said to be inspired by the real-life murder of 14-year-old Bobby Franks in 1924 by University of Chicago students Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb. The film is 80 minutes long, and Wikipedia lists the release date as August 26, 1948, in the New York City premiere, and then general release of September 25, 1948. The film is one of Hitchcock's most experimental and one of the most interesting experiments ever attempted by a major director working with big box office names, abandoning many standard film techniques to allow for the long, unbroken scenes. Each shot ran continuously for up to 10 minutes, which was the camera's film capacity, without interruption. It was shot on a single set, aside from the opening establishing shot street scene under the credits. Camera moves were carefully planned, and there was almost no editing. Now, there are, I noticed, at least three cuts in the film. Did you guys happen to notice any cuts at all in the film? There was at least three.
Yeah.
Where they were, it was not a smooth transition.
Yeah.
I noticed the transitions, but yeah, no, they're, you know, somewhat invisible.
Yeah, so yeah, I think there's three or four in the movie.
Yes.
Yeah, the but what I mean is there's one scene after they're talking about choking the chicken. Now keep it clean, you guys. And when they cut directly to Rupert, and it's not a motion thing. It's a cut from a film to film. So there, it's one of the times when they break the smooth. And the other one is when the woman guest comes in. I can't remember her name right now. That was another one that I noticed. They just cut to her, and then I noticed one more, but I can't remember it off the top of my head right now. So it's not entirely one continuous take. There are a few cuts from angles, in the film. Just a couple of them though. The walls of the set were on rollers and could silently be moved out of the way to make way for the camera and then replaced when they were to come back into shot. Prop men constantly had to move the furniture and other props out of the way of the large Technicolor camera and then ensure they were replaced in the correct location. A team of sound men and camera operators kept the camera and microphone in constant motion as the actors kept to a carefully choreographed set of cues. The filming technique, which conveys the impression of continuous action, also serves to lengthen the duration of the action in the mind of the viewer. In the 2002 article in Scientific American, Antonio Damasio argues that the time frame covered by the movie, which lasts 80 minutes and is supposed to be in real time, is actually longer, a little more than 100 minutes. This, he states, is accomplished by speeding up the action. The formal dinner lasts only 20 minutes, the sun sets too quickly, and so on. Actor James Stewart found the whole process highly exasperating, saying the really important thing being rehearsed here is the camera, not the actors. Much later, Stewart said of the film, "It was worth trying. Nobody but Hitch would have tried it, but it really didn't work." The cyclorama in the background was the largest backing ever used on a soundstage. It included models of the Empire State and Chrysler buildings, numerous chimneys with smoke, lights come on in buildings, neon signs light up, and the sunset slowly unfolds as the movie progresses. Within the course of the film, the clouds made of spun glass change position and shape 8 times. Now, as for the actors, James Maitland Stewart was born May 20th, 1908, and died July 2nd, 1997, was an American actor and military officer. Known for his distinctive drawl and everyman scream persona, Stewart had a film career that spanned over 55 years from 1935 and 1991, and 80 films. With the strong morality he portrayed both on and off the screen, Stewart epitomized the American ideal in 20th century United States. In 1999, the American Film Institute ranked him 3rd on its list of the greatest American male actors. Born and raised in Indiana, Pennsylvania, Stewart started acting while studying at Princeton University. After graduating in 1932, he began a career as a stage actor, appearing on Broadway and in summer stock productions. In 1935, he signed a film contract with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. The studio did not see leading man material in Stewart, but after 3 years of supporting roles and being loaned out to other studios, he had his big breakthrough in Frank Capra's ensemble comedy You Can't Take It With You from 1938. The following year, Stewart garnered his 1st of 5 Academy Award nominations for his portrayal of an idealized and virtuous man who becomes a senator in Capra's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington from 1939. He won his only Academy Award for Best Actor for his work in the screwball comedy The Philadelphia Story in 1940, which also starred Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant. This is the first of 4 appearances. We will see him again in Rear Window, The Man Who Knew Too Much Remake, and Vertigo. John Dahl was an American actor, primarily a stage actor. He is best remembered today for 2 film roles, the cool-minded intellectual killer in Hitchcock's Rope and the trigger-happy lead in the 1950 film noir Gun Crazy. He also had a substantial role in Stanley Kubrick's Spartacus from 1960, and he first came to fame as the young prodigy who comes alive under the tutelage of Betty Davis in The Corn is Green from 1945, for which he was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. This is his only Hitchcock appearance. Farley Earl Granger Jr. was an American actor best known for his two collaborations with Hitchcock, Rope in 48 and Strangers on a Train in 1951. Granger was first noticed in a small stage production in Hollywood by a Goldwyn casting director and given a significant role in The North Star, a controversial film praising the Soviet Union at the height of World War II, but later condemned for its political bias. Another war film, The Purple Heart, followed before Granger's naval service in Honolulu in a unit that arranged troop entertainment in the Pacific. Here he made useful contacts including Bob Hope, Betty Grable, and Rita Hayworth. It was also where he began exploring his bisexuality, which he said he never felt any need to conceal. In 1948, Hitchcock cast him in Rope, a fictionalized account of the Leopold and Loeb murder case, which earned mixed reviews, but much critical praise for Granger. Hitchcock then cast him again in Strangers on a Train as a tennis star drawn into a double murder plot by a wealthy psychopath played by Robert Walker. Granger would describe this as his happiest filmmaking experience and was deeply saddened by Walker's death shortly after shooting. Granger continued to appear on stage, film, and television well into his 70s. His work ranged from classical drama on Broadway to several Italian-language films and major documentaries about Hollywood. He tended to find fault with his directors and scriptwriters, however, and his career remains defined by the two Hitchcock films. So I'm looking forward to revisiting Strangers on a Train. I haven't seen that in a while. And last we'll talk about is Joan Chandler, who is an American actress who notably starred in Rope. But she's the daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Carl Cheeseman. Chandler was born in Butler, Pennsylvania, and she took piano lessons from her musician mother and began studying ballet when she was five. She attended Butler High School and the School of Arts at Bemington College. She also studied at the Neighborhood Playhouse School of the Theater in New York. Before she became a professional actress, Chandler toured with a ballet company. A founding member of the Actors Studio, Chandler appeared in several feature films, five Broadway plays, and about 12 television programs such as Studio One and Starlight Theater. She was married twice, first to David McKay, with whom she had one daughter, and then to Dr. Charles C. Hogan. Both marriages ended in divorce. Chandler died at the age of 55 of cancer in New York City, and this is her only Hitchcock appearance. Now, did you guys notice the Hitchcock cameo?
I didn't notice it, but I read up on it.
Yeah, I couldn't see it either.
Yeah, I didn't see it because I watched it when I was making breakfast, so I didn't see it.
It's the Reducto Fat Slimmer ad on a billboard in the diorama in the background. I didn't see it, but I just read about.
So it's like the one in Lifeboat, except it's on.
And Hitchcock himself says. He's like, I've appeared in every film in a cameo. How are we going to, there's only 9 people in the room. I can't just walk into the room. He could have been a delivery boy or a bellman or something. But, yeah, he was challenged to try and figure out a way to pull off his cameo.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was something interesting. I was reading in Donald Spotto's book, 50 Years of His Motion, or The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, 50 Years of His Motion Pictures. So we talked about how much trouble Hitchcock had with David O. Selznick and working with him and the tight constraints that David O. Selznick put him under. And so Hitchcock was very excited to open up his own production studio and become a film producer. So he had this thing called Transatlantic Pictures, but it ended up that there was only 2 films that were produced under the title of Transatlantic Pictures. And what it says in here is that by the time the contract was to expire, Hitchcock was more than ever determined to be his own producer, to earn a producer's fee, to select his own properties, to engage a cast, to have complete creative control over every aspect of production, and to dictate the form of the final cut. Rope and Under Capricorn were the first 2 films he produced with business cooperation from an English colleague named Sidney Bernstein under their company banner Transatlantic Pictures. The name derived from the intent to make a series of films alternately in London and Hollywood. These first 2 pictures were both made in Technicolor and released by Warner Brothers and were both box office failures. Transatlantic then quietly folded, and in 1950, Hitchcock signed to produce and direct as an independent with Warner financing and distributing. So he ended up being back under the studio control again after only 2 movies. I thought that was really, really fascinating and really too bad because he was so excited to get out of underneath the thumb of Selznick. So, anywho. Right on. Well, let's jump into the discussion of the film, and let's talk about the technique of filming this movie first off, with the intended long takes, the intended no cuts, hiding the cuts by moving the camera into people's backs and whatnot. Chris, what did you think of this style of technique? Because a lot of people criticize this movie and they think that it's gimmicky and cheesy.
Oh, I don't. I was because, like I said, you know, I'd seen Rope a number of years ago, but I hadn't revisited it until the past couple of days. And I watched it while I was kind of doing stuff. And then for the second half of the film, I just sat and just watched it all the way through and really enjoyed it. In terms of the editing, so it's edited by William Ziegler, who was one of the really famous or, you know, really prolific film editors of the 20th century. So Ziegler edited...
Oh boy, that is like the easiest paycheck ever.
No, I know, but it's done so creatively and it's done so smartly as well. And he would work with Hitchcock on Strangers on a Train, and he did My Fair Lady and The Music Man and kind of all these great films. So he edited over 100 films, and I think it's done so well. And it's a really interesting choice to do, because out of, you know, all of the films that Hitchcock's done, I think it's really interesting that this one is the one that feels most like a stage production, and the one that basically feels as though it's been mm-hmm. copy and pasted straight into the film format. So I don't really get where people are coming from when they're saying, like, oh, it's a gimmick that it's all cut and all that sort of thing. I mean, nowadays, you know, it is more common to have these long, you know, unbroken takes, whether it's like Alfonso Cuarón in Children of Men, or if it's Steve McQueen, or, you know, any of the directors who like doing these long one-take shots. But I just think it makes it very different. I think it's very interesting because, if anything, because the camera is more dynamic and has to follow people or has to, you know, stay in a corner and keep them at a distance, it makes it more interesting, and it makes the choices more interesting, because you're not getting a close-up of everyone's face every 5 seconds, mm-hmm. as in modern film, where it's like, oh, well, what's your reaction to this, and what's your reaction to that? It's like, no, because there is some distance, and it's a... I wouldn't say it's a colder film by any scene, but you're not always there with your characters. You don't immediately mm-hmm. latch onto them and all that sort of thing. And I think it just lends itself really well.
Mm-hmm. Tom, what are your thoughts on the long takes?
The challenge as the viewer is to decide, are you going to watch the film and enjoy the story? Or are you going to watch the film thinking about, oh, hey, they're doing this as a one-take experimental film? So because the nature of what the three of us do is we're critiquing films, we're talking about them, and, you know, going into the viewing, we realize we're going to be talking about the photography and the long takes. It's the challenge is there to try and relax and just watch the story and enjoy the story. And I'm guessing that the viewers back in 1958 that watched this, or 1959, would have probably known about the photography tricks before they went in.
I wonder if they would have. Like we know, the first time I saw Rope, I knew about it because it was talked about. This is the one where he tried to do this. But I wonder how much knowledge people would have had about that at the time.
Yeah, like, it's not the social media thing of like today, where mm-hmm. everything explodes on day one of release. They might have had more of a challenge to learn about the film before they went in. But, you know, whether or not they knew it, like, could you honestly just sit and watch this film without realizing, hey, that camera moved into the back of his jacket and then cut to another reel? Like, you should be able to enjoy the story without being distracted by the photography tricks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, we're so deep into, like, I personally am all about the camera stuff, right, and the photography, and I'm all interested in that it's a challenge to just enjoy the story. But it is a really good story when you look at it. Like, the film itself is very entertaining.
Captivating.
And the mounting pressure, the mounting tension, and the claustrophobic nature of it all happening pretty much in one room. Like, it's really a well-done film.
Mm-hmm.
So we really owe it to ourselves to just try and enjoy the story, watch the story, and take advantage of it, right?
Yeah. I love how choreographed it is. Like, it's done really precisely and really enjoyably. So there's moments where... And the thing that made me think of this is there's a bit where... I can't remember if it's Philip or if it's the other one, but one of them walks into the kitchen, and it's as the door swings, you then see something incriminating happen, and it swings, and then the minute it's done, it's all that sort of thing. I think that's just... For me, that's such a gorgeous little moment of, oh, okay, this was planned, this was shot, this was rehearsed, and it's not a cheap way of like, okay, we'll show a cut of him dropping in, or we'll show this, or there's a brilliant moment where the camera locks itself with the table, and it stays there, and you watch the housekeeper walk very far away, and she's there packing stuff up, and it builds tension because you're with, you know, the chest. And I just think it's just done so well.
Mm-hmm. You have to appreciate the effort that they went through, right? You have to be thankful for all the work that they did to do what they did to make the film, right?
Mm-hmm. I wonder if, like, watching this movie, I think that the cuts are clumsy. Like when he moves the camera into somebody's back or whatever to try and hide the cut, it really draws attention to the cut. And I almost think that this movie would have been better had he just utilized, like, if it's 10 minutes a thing, let's say there's 8 cuts in this movie. I'm sorry I don't have the number. I think it almost would have been better if there was just 8 cuts to a new camera setup every time he ran out of film. But because, like you're saying, yes, the utilization of the long takes is masterful. The two examples that you gave, the Brandon character, when they show him dropping the rope into the drawer in the kitchen, like, I laugh every time I see it because it's so well choreographed. And I called Aubrey's attention to the emptying of the table scene because I'm like, hey, Aubrey, watch this. And she didn't know it was coming, but just keeping it on the housekeeper, you know, you're listening to what's going on, but you're focused on the housekeeper. It's just like, oh my goodness, they don't realize what's going on. It builds someone. And Aubrey was literally on the edge of her seat during that whole sequence. And all you're doing is watching somebody walk back and forth, right? But you would have completely lost the tension if at any time you cut away from that housekeeper, you know? I think it would not have had the same impact at all.
Brandon, you and I are people that I've talked to about this film over the years. We've always come up with this supposition or this proposal. If Hitchcock had digital technology like today and could have shot this film in one complete long take, would he have done it? Would it have made, like, it would have been possible to do it if they could have got the actors to do what they needed to do, right? Like, the digital photography today would allow them to do that. And that would make it truly seamless.
Yes.
But, again, I think it's the suspension of disbelief. You just have to kind of let yourself relax and go, okay, don't worry about that cut or that edit, and just try and enjoy the story and just try and fall into the movie itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that had he had access to digital technology and, like, a hard drive camera where he could record 80 minutes nonstop, he definitely would have done it. And I do believe that the movie would have been better. And I think that it would have would not have had any type of negative criticism. I mean, I haven't seen it yet, but we recently had 1917, I think it was. That was a movie that was intended to be as one take. Right. And there was another one, and I don't know what it was, but there was like a German film or something a couple years ago that came out, and they did the whole thing in one take. But it's something that's been inspired, and it's inspired people to do this. And I mean, you know, in TV shows and stuff, when they do long takes, I love long takes because I love the work that's gone into it. I mean, in True Detective, I think it's episode 3 or 4 of True Detective season 1, there's this amazing long take. And all of this stuff is inspired by what Hitchcock tried to do with this movie, you know? And I just love it, and I love what he tried to do. I just think it would have been better if he just would have acknowledged the limitation of the camera and done a completely new setup with each take. That's the only criticism I have of the movie. But, you know,
like 1917, again, sitting, like, I knew when it came out that I didn't want to know anything about the film. I was planning to go see it, and when I went and saw it, I tried to be as, in a good way, ignorant as I could about the film. Like, I didn't read the internet about it.
So and you didn't know that it was trying to do a one take?
I knew that was the reason. I knew it was promoted as being a one take film. So I deliberately didn't read up on it ahead of time.
Okay.
And I went in, and you can tell, yes, there's a take, there's a cutaway here, there's a cutaway there. But again, if you just sort of relax, fall into the story, and let it happen, and realize that the duration of this whole film is meant to be within about a 2-hour real-life time frame, it is very enjoyable. And they're doing, like Olympic efforts in 1917 as far as moving the camera through physical space, right? Through sets and through buildings. And, like, they're doing an amazing job, like, of pulling off the long takes that they did to make that film. And they're doing, you know, they're doing a heroic effort. So I don't discredit these films that, you know, I don't like to sit there and go, hey, I saw that take. I'm pretty clever. I figured out that there was a take. I try and just enjoy the storyline. And if the film came out to modest reviews, Hitchcock's Rope came out to modest reviews and modest box office, big deal. Like, it was a very well done film. Obviously, we're appreciating it this much later on. Like, it's a historic film. And I think Hitchcock deserved to be able to do what he wanted to do experimentally, like to use his paintbrush to do different things, right? Mm-hmm. And we should give him credit for making that effort. But really, when you realize the stuff that, like Jimmy Stewart was talking about, you know, how many weeks he was on set before he actually appeared on camera, and the tension on these, like the pressure on these actors, that if they flubbed a line and 9 minutes into a scene and literally an entire day's work would be ruined and have to be scrapped because they'd have to redo it. The pressure on these actors is immense, given a lot of them were stage actors. Like Chris mentioned, it's a stage feel. It feels like a play. These were stage actors that were skilled at reading for a long time. And an interesting part of the dialogue you see in this film that you don't see in a lot of films is double talk. There's two conversations happening front and back of each other at the same time, which film and TV will never do that because they don't give the viewer enough credit to be able to follow two conversations at once. So it really does have a very skilled cast. One of the things that, like, an example of what I saw, which would have been a an acting flub that in a typical film would have had the director call for a retake, is when Stewart has, they have the tussling match over the loaded gun, and the gun goes off, and Stewart, you assume he got like a bit of powder burn, a bit of heat burn on his left hand. So he takes a kerchief and he tries to wrap his hand. And when you're watching it, he's kind of like, he's obviously kind of a little bit in trauma or shocked and stumbling a bit, but he's a little too awkward in the way he's trying to wrap his hand with the kerchief. And little things like that, I think otherwise would have called for a retake, but they get left in because, you know, we're soldiering through the scene. We're not going to stop for little tiny flubs.
Yeah, see, it's interesting because Aubrey asked me what happened, and I've seen this movie, I don't know how many times I've seen this movie, right? And watching it, I'm like, oh yeah, that's exactly what I said, was he must have got a powder burn. And I explained to her what that was. But then you see a later shot later on where the handkerchief on his hand is covered in blood, and it's like, oh, no, I guess he must have been supposed to have been shot in the hand. So I think it's kind of funny. But anyways, well, let's talk about the color in the film, okay? So here we are. I was going to make a joke at the beginning that there must have been something wrong with my TV because there was all these weird colors going on. But I forgot. I went the other way. I went with the good friend Chris. But this is our first color film by Hitchcock, right? And this is pretty amazing. Right. I mean, it's Technicolor, right? Which is, it's a very interesting style of photography, you know, like it's a very interesting color process. And I'm not the biggest fan of Technicolor itself. Like, you can really tell when you've got a Technicolor film. I mean, whatever. I mean, like, it's just, it was the first color film, so it's better than nothing, I guess. But what do you think? Does Hitchcock work in color? Because we got a couple color films, and then he does go back to black and white a few times after this. With Psycho, there was a specific reason that he chose black and white, and that was because of the blood in the shower scene. It wouldn't have passed censor, so that's why he did black and white for that one. But even still, we have The Wrong Man coming up later on. That is a black and white film, and I Confess, I believe, is also a black and white, if I remember correctly. It's been a while since I've seen that one. Tom, what do you think of the color?
I don't mind it. Like, it looks like the way a film of that era should look, right? Mm-hmm. It is. And it didn't even trigger on me that this would have been his first color film. I just know, you know, it just looked like a good film of the era. There was a lot of talk about the trouble that Hitchcock had with the background, the diorama, and something about halfway through production, he hadn't been looking at the dailies. He hadn't been reviewing the film that was shot each day, and he didn't like the color, and they had to redo a bunch of stuff. So he had a bit of a struggle with the whole idea. And I remember reading a while back that there was something about the final take that it didn't look correct. And again, they had to reshoot because of the visual effect of the diorama of New York's skyline. But I enjoyed the color looked fine to me. It did not look unusual. It looked pretty natural.
Mm-hmm. Chris?
Yeah, no, I mean, I kind of have to agree with Tom. I mean, I think the way we think about this as well is that for many people, this is one of Hitchcock's big, one of his first kind of big films, one of those that's really critically lauded and continues to be analysed and so on and so forth. So the colour for me, I thought it was fine. I didn't think it was anything, it was neither sort of offensively bad or kind of something to really write home about. I kind of have to agree with Technicolor in the sense of when it's done well, I enjoy it. But when it's like everything's turned up to like 11 on the saturation dial or everything's just really overdone, it really detracts away from the meaning in the film. And it really, because colour obviously in film has its own kind of psychology and its connotations and it, you know, everything's placed in there for a specific reason. With this, mm-hmm. I thought it was absolutely fine. I mean, if this was, for example, Hitchcock's first sort of experiment in colour, if you haven't tried any short films or anything like that, I think it works really well. I just think that he's able to use the medium a lot better going forward. So it's not a bad place to start, really.
The color is interesting to see, and it'll be interesting to take a look in the next film as well. What's the next one? Under Capricorn, I think, is the next one. Because that one's color as well. It'll be interesting to see how the color goes in that one. Because I haven't seen that movie yet, so I'm not sure what it's how it's going to boil down. But I guess the other big elephant in the room we'll talk about then is the relationship between the two leads. So watching the movie again, I'm watching it and I'm like, they are hammering hard on the head that these guys are just friends. Like, really, really hard. They're just good friends that room together, right? But then, I mean, you've got weird things like he's going to go up, he's always going up to stay with his buddy's mother, right, and spend time with the family and stuff like this. At the end of the day, watching this, because we had talked about this earlier, I'm like, I don't know, I haven't seen this in years, but I'm like, I never caught that they were gay or anything like that. But watching it now, I'm like, okay, the subtext is definitely there. But at the end of the day, I don't think it matters either way, whether or not they are just roommates, just schoolmates, or whether they are together. I don't think it matters either way. Does it matter, Chris?
For me, no. I mean, as the kind of the voice and all queer stuff for this podcast, it's kind of funny look at it and being like, oh yeah, this is the subtext is nearly text, basically, because you're like, oh, okay, they're just friends who stare like incredibly intensely at each other and commit crime, and you're like, okay, this is so gay. It's fine. Listen, it's part of the whole. Like, we did it with Rebecca, and it was like, oh, hello, Mrs. Danvers, evil murder lesbian. it's a bit of a queerness evil thing that was a real trope in the kind of 40s and 50s, and it's fine. I mean, it's not fine, but it's fine. I think it's interesting because it really, in the stage play, it really does hammer home that the Leopold and Loeb characters, like, oh yeah, they're in a relationship, and they are kind of obsessive, and they happen to be gay, and you know, that sort of thing. I mean, it's ironic. Before I watched Rope this week, I started watching the Sandra Bullock movie Murder by Numbers. I don't know if you guys know that one, which is basically...
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
I don't recall that at all.
So Murder by Numbers is basically, what if that you did Rope, but they were teenagers and straight, and it was set in 2001? It's not very good, but it has baby Ryan Gosling in it, so I'm kind of like, oh, all right, that's fine. I'm serious, he's like 18, you're just like, oh, wow, okay, he is young.
So he's definitely a Gosling.
Yeah, he is a Gosling. Gosling.
He's a Gosling. Yeah. Gosling.
He's not Ryan Swan yet. but what is? No, that's a Signet. Ryan Goose. But what is interesting about it, in the same conceit kind of travels over in the same way that we've had different iterations of Rear Window or Strangers on the Train or that sort of thing. The idea of two people teaming up to commit the perfect murder, it does translate. For Rope, it's a bit of subtext that isn't necessarily neither here nor there. I think if you were to remake it today, it'd be quite interesting to see what subtext you could do with James Stewart's character, because it's, you know, oh, they were at like a prestigious boarding school. Is there some kind of element going on with that? And the way it's framed, in the if you look at the screen time and you look at the perspectives and everything, the two villains are our protagonists, really.
Mm-hmm.
And the person they're fighting against is, you know, James Stewart. And it's quite interesting in that you start off with the villain, and it's the villain's perspective you take, because it opens on them literally killing David with the rope and all that sort of thing. In terms of the queerness, because I know we've had this conversation on the podcast before, where it was like, does Rope count as a kind of an LGBT, like a pride film? And I'm like, well, not really, because it's not an intrinsic part of them. So they are together, but they are stated like, oh, well, they're just close friends, or they're just like partners, or that sort of thing. But it's not something that is A, really positive, nor is it kind of an essential part of the film. So I would say no, but I think it's a really interesting reading. And, you know, looking back on it, I'm not saying Hitchcock was some kind of secret. It's really pushing like queer-coded characters to the lens or anything, but you know, in Rebecca and in this, and in stuff like Frenzy or in kind of other films that have a darker element to them, it is funny to just kind of look back and go, "Oh, this is so gay."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because a lot of there's a trope in cinema, like I learned about when I was watching Star Trek Discovery Season 1, bury your gaze,
yes.
You know, and then the gay characters are always the bad guys, they're always the criminals, like, there's not a lot of positive gay representation in cinema, and so I'm watching this, and I'm like, yeah, is this a, like, yeah, fine, the subtext is there, but is that a good thing, because they're killers, like, so we got these two gay guys, but they're murderers, so, I mean, yes, we've got it. A lot of straight people who are murderers in movies, but it's like at this time in Hollywood, gay people were always bad in some way, or they were always killed, or something along those lines, right?
They're the murderers, but they're the heroes of the film. Like, the film wouldn't have happened without the murder, and I don't think of them in them as murderers in a bad way. Like, they're almost like murderers that you have respect for. And you kind of admire the fact that they're willing to do a murder out of philosophical intrigue.
So what,
you know?
So what I'm taking from this, Tom, is that you condone murder. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Tom's real name is Rupert Caldwell.
Yeah, but they're just like...
The point that you made, Brandon, about the fact that was it Farley was going to go up to Brandon's mother's house for a week or two to practice piano before his big recital, and that kind of like, that's kind of weird. But then my thought on that was these are just sort of richy rich New York
yeah.
University boys, and they're kind of frat boys, and they're kind of like, you know, they're all on the rowing team. They kind of, they go cottage at each other's lakes and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not that unusual that they might go visit other, you know, their friends' houses mm-hmm. or their friends' cottages. But again, that could be the gay subtext at the same time.
I really thought you said they go cottaging, and I'm like, that is something different entirely. And I don't know if it's like a UK-specific term, but I'm like, oh, okay, that is... it is that weird subtext. I'm just like, oh, okay, they're almost a couple, but not really. And it is, I think you are completely right in that, because they are the upper-class kind of prep school, like, oh, well, he's an old classmate, and it's that circle mm-hmm. where they can get away with it a little bit more. One thing I would like to say, there is a great video by James Summerton, who is a kind of queer film critic, that basically breaks down all of the stuff that Brandon was talking about, which is kind of the bury your gaze trope and kind of how queer people in cinema and that sort of thing. So if it's something you're interested in, it's on YouTube. It's great. It's like an hour and a half long. Mm-hmm. So I would...
We'll have to check that out.
It's good.
Brandon, you're such a fan of this movie, and one of the characters' names is Brandon Shaw, and your name is Brandon Shea.
Were you named after the film? There? Or was the film
I may have you name yourself after the character? Yeah.
I may have. This is my stage name, actually. Brandon Shaw. Shea-aw. So,
Shaw.
Yeah. I always... It's weird. There's not many people in cinema with the name Brandon. There aren't many. Like I can think of two off of the top of my head for, like, characters. There's this guy... And then the big brother in the Goonies is Brandon, right? So, like, right. There's not many. You know, Tom, though, you've said it in my head. These guys aren't gay. They're just rich.
There you go.
they just act like rich people, which can be confused with gay, I guess. Right, Chris?
I mean, first thing in my head, I was like, I'm not gay. I'm just poor. That's the difference. Yeah, not gay, just rich. I mean, if that's not on a T-shirt,
think about the era, like 1959, 1960. The tolerance in Hollywood and the tolerance in media and society in the United States in general, right?
Well, this was earlier. This is 48. Characters
would have been.
Yeah, this is the '40s.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, it's 1950.
Yeah.
I was 10 years off, so it's even earlier. The negativity against gay characters would be even stronger, right?
Yeah.
Than it would be today. Like, there's a lot more tolerance today, but back then it would have been any little tiny hint would have just really exploded as far as something that people would have been against, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at, like, say the Maltese Falcon, which I believe was 1941, I want to say, one of the villains is gay in the original, I think it's Dashiell Hammett book. And it's left a subtext and kind of just implied, like, oh, he's just eccentric, or he's just evil. Or one of my favorite ever thrillers, which is Laura, and it came out in 1944 or 45. Basically, one of the characters is like, oh, well, of course I was in love with her, and he is the gayest man in the world who was in love with this woman. And I'm like, are you though? But are you though? And there's even it kind of would continue on for a few decades, and so there's a... I can't remember the name of the film, but it's got Audrey Hepburn and Shirley MacLaine in it. It's is it The Teaching Hour or something? Or basically, it's about two teachers who get accused of being lesbians, and it ends mm-hmm. up horribly. And it's based on a play where it doesn't end, like, that badly. But in the film, they were like, no, we're going to make them suffer and make them die. And it's just... It was a real weird time. I mean, the Hays Code pretty much prevented anything that wasn't, you know, it was like, oh, if it's considered like sodomy, or if it's considered bad practice, so there never would have been kind of premarital sex or abortion or kind of anything remotely what you consider feminist for a good few decades after, or, you know, after the Hays Code was introduced. And then you really started mm-hmm. getting more stuff towards, like Tom said, towards the sort of mid to late 50s into the 60s, and then the 60s really started pushing stuff and all that sort of thing. But yeah, you know, like, bury your gaze is still a huge thing. There was a huge controversy a few years ago when loads of TV shows did it in a month. It was something like June 2016. They killed someone off on The Walking Dead. They did two characters on another show, another character on like all these popular teen shows, and they were like, what's with all the dead lesbians within 4 weeks? So
okay, although I understand the trope, but I will give a pass on Walking Dead because there's like most characters don't last much more than a season. So
oh, yeah,
there's
yeah.
the they're not doing much on that one for like
no, I know it was more it was the timing. They were just like, Jesus, how many like
it's not called The Walking Living.
Yeah.
No, I know, but it was just funny. They were just like, my God, we can't move for all the dead lesbians on TV. It's just they're just everywhere.
So I'll talk a bit about Aubrey's reaction to this. So I watch it with her, and you know, like, so she watched it, she loved it, she was captivated. But like right at the beginning, when they talk about serving the meal on there, like this is probably Hitchcock's most disturbing film. Like when you sit and you think about what's going on, and you actually think about what these two guys are doing, this is probably his most disturbing film. And like Aubrey's like, these guys are sick, and I'm like, so I'm watching with her. I'm like, are you okay watching this? Because the movie's pretty tame. It's all in the dialogue and whatnot that's being spoken about, and knowing what's going on. And she was fine with it. She said she was fine. I mean, like she's pretty mature for her age with what she watches. But this is some pretty. This is a pretty shocking story that's going on, and I think that that gets lost, right? I think that that is not quite realized as much. It doesn't seem to be spoken of very much about how dark this story actually is.
Yeah. It's quite macabre when you actually think about it, because it's not just, oh, they're planning on getting away with a murder and kind of all that sort of thing. It's like, no, we're going to get away with the murder, but we're going to hide the
and
body.
And the guy's dad.
Oh, I know. It's a sort of black humour, dark humour that just, it works well on the stage. And I think it works well here. I think it translates really well. Mm-hmm. But you are right in that, you know, this is compared to Hitchcock, who, there are films where there are out and out serial killers, and it's not as dark in context as Rope. And I think that really helps bring it out. I mean, I'm glad that Aubrey enjoyed it. And I'm glad that she wasn't put off by like, oh well, here's the cold chicken and here's the ice cream and they're just resting on top of the thing containing a corpse. But when you break it down, you're like, oh, how does this get shown like in the daytime where like children can watch it?
Right. Would either of you, if you had to, is there such a person that has never seen a Hitchcock film? If you had to try and introduce a film fan to Hitchcock, would you say watch Rope as your first example of
Hitchcock? I don't think so. I don't think I would recommend this as a first viewing of Hitchcock if they'd never seen any. No, I would go to something like
Northwest. It stands alone, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely does.
This
I would probably
really
go to
unique...
Northwest as a first time for somebody.
This is a very unique, it's almost like a subgenre within Hitchcock itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't really match up any of his other films, really, that I can think of. And I think it's an important film to view when you're trying to understand Hitchcock in the big spectrum, but not a prime example of what his films are.
And again, the reason why this kind of feels weird, right? Like, same with the last one, the parodying case, is like, most of the time, what we know of as Hitchcock is the innocent man on the run, the falsely accused. And in this one here, we've got guilty people from the opening shot. You know, in the end of the last movie, the parodying case, we found out that she was guilty, right? You know, and we've had a few examples, not many, probably three or four maybe at most so far, where it doesn't fit that example. But yeah, it's weird because these guys are guilty. And I think that's what makes it almost not feel like a Hitchcock film.
Now, if Hitchcock likes to... he likes to tell the viewer that there's a bomb under the table and then make them wait 5 minutes for the bomb to explode. Is he forcing us to wait for 90 minutes to have these murderers... found out for having murdered? Like, is this a 90-minute bomb under the table?
Yeah.
Yep, that's what it is, that's for sure.
it's sort of MacGuffin and Chekhov's corpse all at once. It's like, well, you introduce it in the opening scene, someone's going to have to come across it. It's going to have to be revealed, because that's the whole conceit of, like, are they going to get away with this murder? Are they going to do all that sort of thing? And they do some fantastic character work, but yeah, absolutely.
I would really cherish the opportunity to have been in the audience when this came out and just have know nothing about it and just really try and enjoy the suspense of it and not come from our kind of perspective where we know what happens and, you know, this kind of violence isn't really as offensive nowadays as it would have been back then. And, you know, to really experience the tension of the audience of the day would have been interesting. Like, how tense was it when that the books are removed from the top of the chest and the lid gets opened a few inches? Like, where people like, don't open the chest! Don't open it! You know? Yeah. Like, how much tension was happening in the minds of the viewer back then?
I think that tension there, like, when I watched the movie and that long scene happens with the house cleaner, at that point in the film, I don't want her to open that. Because at that time in the film, I'm rooting for Brandon and Philip. You know, and it's weird how Hitchcock manipulates us in this film. And is it Hitchcock that's manipulating us, or is it the playwright that's manipulating us into feeling this way, right? But when it's like, oh my goodness, they're going to get caught, and you don't want them to get caught. But then at the end, when we have that final scene with Jimmy Stewart, it's like, he needs to open that up and so we can put this to rest, because these guys have done this and they're sick and twisted. You know, it's really fascinating to be yanked about like that emotionally while watching this movie.
Yeah. No, yeah, I completely agree. I mean, it's interesting because you do... I don't know if I could ever say I empathize with them, but I was on with them for the journey. And I was really intrigued. I was like, okay, where's this going to go? Where's this going to... And you were right, when she kind of, she's moving, tidying stuff up and all that sort of thing. I initially wasn't thinking, I don't want him to get away with it. I just thought, I don't want her to see it, because... I half thought for a second, I thought, oh God, what if they kill her? And I was like, oh, okay, is that where this is going? And it didn't, and obviously it got subverted and everything. But I think, yeah, it could not have ended any other way, simply for the fact that if Jimmy Stewart walks away, that is not the end to a film. If they get away with it, there is, because otherwise it's like nothing is brought up. And, you know, Hitchcock was very much into the idea of, like, okay, here's natural justice, poetic justice. You know, they have got away with it, and it's not as if David did them a wrong. You know, he was just a classmate who happened to date Brandon's ex-girlfriend, or, you know, was involved with this or involved with that. So he didn't do anything wrong, so there wasn't any kind of vengeance getting away with it, kind of Murder on the Orient Express style. So it needed to be aired. That I thought was just... I love the last scene, because once Jimmy Stewart fires the gun into the night and you just slowly pull away, and the way it's composed as well, I think, is well done. So you have him sat down, you have Brandon drinking, and you have Philip on the piano, and it's just... it's, for me, it's one of the best shots of Hitchcock I've seen. Because it's all composed so well, and it manages to catch each of the characters, and it just, you know, they each have their own emotional journeys and everything. So Brandon's obviously more of the dominant leader, and Philip's more of the passive, who is just really anxious and nervous and all that sort of thing. And then even Rupert, that's his name, Rupert goes on this journey of like, oh, he was so determined and like, yeah, well, I believe in this, and I believe in this, and that sort of thing. And then now he sees his beliefs put into practice, he's horrified by them, and he sort of renounces himself at the end of the film, and he says, I don't believe in the Ubermensch, or I don't believe in, you know, De Quincey's beliefs and all that sort of thing. So I just think it's, considering the fact that these three are the main characters, I think they each go on a journey, and I think it's just, it's a really well done character exercise.
And the build up of the audio outside, like the people in the streets, the sirens coming closer and whatnot. So
how it slowly fades in, and you, after the shots, you sort of hear like a little bit of like, oh my God, what was that? And then at the end, where you see the lights, you hear the sirens, and over the music and everything. And yeah, I think it's, I won't say a perfect ending, but it's just, it's the perfect way to end that right. film. Yeah.
Right. Awesome. Well, is there anything else that we haven't discussed yet that you want to talk about, Tom?
I think we can tie this one up.
Chris, anything we haven't addressed yet that you want to talk about?
No, and I can't think of a funny pun, so I'm good.
Awesome. Yeah, I think I'm good as well.
Oh, no, wait. I think not.
Oh.
I'm so proud. No, shut up. I'm so
Boo
proud.
Boo pun. Boo pun.
You roped me in with that one.
Hey. Okay, now we're all awful. Okay.
We're trying to keep listeners, not chase them away, gentlemen.
not lose them. So, excellent. Right on. Well, Tom, give this a rating. How would you rate this bad boy? And is it still your favorite Hitchcock film?
I am going to reserve my decision for my favorite Hitchcock film until we've watched them all.
Okay.
But, yeah, this is totally my, you know, right up there. I'm actually going to give this 5 out of 5 broken candlesticks.
Nice. Yeah, as a rewatch, this completely won me over, so I'm going to give it 5 out of 5 balls of ice cream that are melting because you put them in the wrong place. They're never going to get eaten otherwise. Why would you put them there?
Excellent, right on. I love this movie. I still love it. And while it's been knocked out of the number one spot for me, that's okay because it's still a masterpiece. I'm going to give this 5 out of 5 first editions. So
there you nice. Go.
Awesome. I love it. Chris, where can people find you when you're not practicing piano at my mum's house?
When I'm not busy practicing piano, nor being like a weird like fortune teller or palm reader or whatever, you can find me on Twitter at @hi_boy. Apart from Good Evening, I have North by Nerd West, which is a podcast that me and my mate Emma Platt do. I'm also on a bunch of other podcasts doing little bits and pieces. So there's Eccentric Earth with Amy Walker, there's Smorgasbord with Pete Gaskell, and there's also, what's the other one I was going to mention? Pick a Disc with Matt Lathan. So please check them all out. They're wonderful people. And yeah, come say hi on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Tom, where can people find you when you're not trying to put the books back in the box?
Well, I'll keep my plug brief and encourage people to get over to YouTube. It's a fairly popular site. A little thing called the Zamboni's Comedy Specials 1993. Something I produced a while ago. Check it out. A couple of half-hour cast comedy episodes from cable TV days. And other than that, thank you anybody that supports us and visits us on Facebook and on Twitter. And anytime we get comments and feedback, we always appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. And as for me, you can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. You can find me over on the Fandom Podcast Network. No, that's this show. Goodness, I got so many. I keep getting confused sometimes. You can find me on the United Federation of Podcast Network with 2 shows, one called Infinite Diversity, which is all about new Star Trek, and one called Franchise Fatigue, which is all about movies, remakes, and sequels. And at this time, we should just have recently finished up our David Fincher podcast on the Nerd Party Network called House of Fincher. We don't have a release date yet for Mank, so I don't know if it's out yet. I don't think it is, but we'll... Hopefully it'll be out soon. I'm very much looking forward to that. That's about Mankiewicz, who wrote Citizen Kane. So that's going to be coming on Netflix pretty soon. Thank you so much to the guys over at the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting our show. You can find us in their feed as well as our own independent feed. Thank you so much to my good friend Jason Cullimore for creating our wonderful theme music. I actually got to see Jason last night. He was over for a fire. We got to just chat and catch up. Woo. It was nice to see him. He had a busy summer working on his what do they call it when you go to school? I can't remember the word. The final thing you got to do for your doctorate.
Thesis.
Thank you.
Performance.
Goodness, I couldn't remember my word there. But it's good to see him. And be sure to check out Annie and Catherine on Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast. They cover all of Hitchcock's episodes on that show in kind of a random order. But with their show and our show combined, you get a near comprehensive look at the Grandmaster's work. And is that it? Who else do I need to thank? I think that's about it.
Yep.
That's it.
Until next time when we cover Under Capricorn. Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.